Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for the Cattlemen's Congress Conversation. A chance to catch up on the nation's best beef cattle show, put on by cattlemen for cattlemen. Now here's your host, Mr. Ron Hayes.
Well, thank you, Kirby, and welcome to our first episode of Season 2 of Cattlemen's Congress Conversation. And today, a really special podcast that we're sharing with you, a special presentation by the greenhouse guru himself, Dr. Frank Mittlener of the University of California, Davis. He was the keynote speaker at Cattlemen's Conference held in May of this year in Stillwater on the campus of Oklahoma State University. Dr. Mittlener was clearly excited to be a part of Cattlemen's Conference as he had the opportunity to interact with some of the leading seed stock and commercial cattle producers in the country and other leaders in the purebred industry and more. Dr. Mittlener told the audience that he is at ground zero when it comes to climate and cattle issues, and that he's done a lot of work in the area of greenhouse gas from animal agriculture. He told those gathered at West Watkins Center that the most concerning greenhouse gas from animal agriculture is clearly methane. Methane is quite different from other greenhouse gases, though, because it's naturally destroyed within about 10 years. While there's a constant source of methane produced by cow herds, it's not contributing to additional global warming because a similar amount of what's produced is also being destroyed on an ongoing basis. Without further ado, let's join now Dr. Frank Mittlener as he offered up his thoughts on methane and the good story he believes that the cattle industry has in regards to greenhouse gases. We're pleased to share Dr. Mittlener's presentation from Cattlemen's Conference on today's Cattlemen's Congress Conversation.
Good evening, everybody. What a great honor and pleasure for me to be here and to see so many friendly faces. I don't always see many friendly faces, and that's why I mention it. I come from you from the land of nuts and nutters, California. And even though it's a dinner occasion here tonight, I'm not a comedian, and what I'm about to talk about is actually a pretty serious topic. But I can tell you, I am pretty much at ground zero of these issues of livestock and climate, livestock in the environment. Anything that's controversial around livestock is playing out where I am. And it's not because I'm there. Can I have my slides, please?
Oh,
there I am. Okay. So what I was asked about to do tonight is to talk to you about livestock and climate in particular. Okay, and a topic that is in the media all the time. A topic that is particularly raised by many of your customers and clients. The McDonald's of the world, the Sam's Club, Walmart, and so on, they are now asking producer organizations, what is your carbon footprint? What is your water footprint? What is your nitrogen footprint? And how does it compare today versus 10 years ago, 20 years ago? And most people have just no idea, right? Have no idea. Now, I've studied this for the last 30 years, so I have kind of an idea, but I can assure you this topic that we'll talk about here tonight is not going away. And whether you personally believe in it, let's say you were to say, I don't believe in climate change. Believe me, your customers, your clients do. And if it's their topic, it is your topic. So what I will do here tonight is I'll first give you a little bit of a global trip where I really describe what other countries, other places do around these topics. And then I will explain to you what I know about methane, and that's a very important part of the discussion. Gets a little technical, but it is really important to understand. And then I show you how a public policy situation has worked out in California, among all places. It actually works out there right now. And I will share to you or with you how the dairy and the beef sector are positioning themselves. And I think there are some lessons learned for you. The most important one is these issues are only issues if you ignore them. If you show that you care, if you show that you do something about them, you'll be surprised how you can pull people into your camp. And I mean it. Tyler mentioned that I'm the director of the CLEAR Center. That's a center that I started 3 years ago because my dean was approached by many stakeholders and asked, how can we amplify this voice that Mittlener and colleagues have? How can we do that? And out came the thought, we need to have a center that puts more firepower behind doing the research on environmental sustainability, but also animal welfare and so on the one side, but then on the other side, making sure that we communicate what we find. We need to have a communications core of this thing that's powerful. And so I formed the center 3 years ago. I now have a very well-working research core and a really well-working communications core. I'm probably the only faculty member in this country that I know of who has hired professional journalists to work with him and for him, professional filmmakers, social media experts, writers. That's what it takes, because we need to have people who speak the same language as those people writing about us or doing films about us. We have to have the ability to making a film, not a one-hour documentary, little five-minute deals, okay? That's what the 20-year-olds today, that's what they consume. So, and we have done that, and I'm really happy, I'm proud of it, and that has gotten us a lot of attention. Some of that attention at the time it comes up is annoying. For example, last November, the New York Times felt it was important to work together with Greenpeace, one of the largest activist organizations of the world, or in the world, to write a hit piece on me. A one-pager, title page in the New York Times, with photo. Okay, that doesn't happen very often in your life, I promise you that. What was the scandal? Did I do something wrong? Did I fudge data? Did I mishandle something, abuse someone? None of that. My problem was that I work with agriculture. An agricultural scientist works with agriculture to reduce emissions. What a scandal. One page, I'm not kidding you. I wrote a rebuttal to this New York Times article, and that rebuttal and the original New York Times piece were read by 54 million people. Now, that's your 15 minutes in life, okay? That's that 15-minute moment. But of those 54 million people who read it, 75% were on my side, and 25% were on the New York Times side. The New York Times learned a lesson. And I also interact with people you normally don't interact with so much. For example, 2 years ago, the famous congresswoman from the Bronx, AOC, had a discussion with a high school group. And these high school kids asked her, in your opinion, what shall we do to reduce our impact on climate? And she said, and I quote, we need to fly less and we need to have fewer farting cows. That's what she said. I immediately sat down because I had learned how to become effective on Twitter, and I tweeted a respectful tweet, but really telling her this topic is too important to be flippant about. And so, the way I wrote it was respectful but clear. She then figured out who I was. Her office contacted mine, and we had a discussion the following week. A second discussion a month later, and a third one another month later. And it totally changed her language around the topic. Livestock plays no more role in any of her communications. We have changed the way that she communicates on that topic. And I have colleagues who tell me, well, why do you do that? Why do you interact with these kind of people? Because we must. We have not done that for too long. It's not good enough for us to talk to each other. We have done that all along. We are good at that. But we now need to talk to the rest of the world, because they think there's something wrong, there's something fishy. Because when they ask questions to a dairyman, for example, you know, I read in social media that there's pus in milk. Is that true? And if those dairymen say no comment, what does that look like? What does that look like? Yeah, there's pus in milk, and we don't want to talk about it. That's what it looks like. And these young kids, they keep asking the same questions, and eventually they will get answers. And guess who those answers will give? A bunch of activists. They give the answers. And there are lots of them out there. If there's one thing I want to tell you, my friends in agriculture, we must stop being the best producers in the world and so super proud of what we do, but we don't talk about it. When people ask us questions, you are the experts in your respective fields. And you need to talk to your families about what you do, to your communities about what you do. You don't need to talk to CNN or the New York Times. But you can talk in your circles, and you should. So that was my soapbox right there. Coming back to the Clear Center, this thing here has fallen asleep, I think. It has fallen asleep. Oh, there it is. So the Clear Center is part of the University of California, of course. I'll not dwell over this, but we are, I would say, a real kind of flagship now. With respect to doing research on sustainability, we have built a lot of facilities. Some of them are unique in the world. Large facilities that allow emissions research of group housed animals, of individual housed animals, welfare research, and so on. On the communication side, if you go to clear.ucdavis.edu, you find a lot of explainers, short pieces that explain things that people ask. So, for example, if a U.S. senator wants to know what soil carbon sequestration, or a New York Times journalist or so, they Google that, and they will get our Clear Center explainer as the first hit. And that happens with dozens and dozens of topics where we educate people who are interested about topics in animal agriculture that interest them. We write blogs. These are longer pieces, very influential. Many of these blogs stimulate journalists to write stories, but now not out of thin air, but with some substance behind it. We are pretty much effective in assisting parts of the media who originally or normally are not too egg-friendly to write stories that are better informed. And then we write new stories ourselves. One day I sat in my backyard and I had a phone call by a guy from Japan. And he said to me, "Hi, my name is," whatever it was, "I'm an influencer on YouTube." And I thought, well, good for you. What can I do for you? And he said, "I would like to interview you. May I?" I said, "Sure." I sat there drinking my iced tea, and he interviewed me for 30 minutes. And then he said, "The piece will be out in 2 weeks." The piece was out 2 weeks later. It's called "Eating Less Meat Won't Save the Planet." And here's why. I could not believe my eyes. After 2 weeks with that thing being online, it was downloaded and watched by 2 million people. And by now, 4 million people. They watched the whole 26-minute interview. And then all my special friends, as I call them, they're not really my special friends, they all went wild and had to write rebuttal pieces and so on. And that boosted my algorithm exponentially. Anyhow, so I just want you to know the times when I was just a scientist, do my peer-reviewed papers, taught my students, and did the typical professorial stuff, those times are over. Of course I do all of that, but I also understand that I have a much greater responsibility today. And that responsibility includes communication with the public, with influencers, with policymakers, and so on, in addition to agricultural stakeholders. My thesis here tonight is managing livestock methane can be part of a climate solution. When my special friends hear that, they think this is greenwashing. I will prove to you tonight that it is not greenwashing, that if we manage methane, that we can have a real good impact in this climate narrative that's out there. I do travel a lot, and I mean a lot. Here you see a couple of images. The top left is from Uruguay, where the president of Uruguay invited me to give testimony before ministers and parliamentarians. At the bottom left, you see me give testimony in Ireland and before the Irish Parliament about livestock and climate. Bottom right is giving testimony before the U.S. Senate. And then, and so on, and so on. So I'm around those places in the world where major environmental issues around livestock are happening. And that is what I found, there, namely that throughout the world, there are different ways that governments deal with livestock issues. The majority of places use what I call the cane approach of using rules and regulations, fines, or taxes to make farmers reduce emissions, the cane approach. So, for example, where do I find the cane approach? New Zealand now has a methane tax for everybody who has ruminant livestock. If you have a cow or a sheep or a goat, you pay tax. And that drives the New Zealand farmers up the walls. It's not a very high tax, but the fact that they are taxed drives them up the walls. When I gave testimony before the Irish Parliament, they had the proposal of significantly shrinking their livestock herds to save the planet from climate change. I told them, if you were to get rid of a third of your cattle in Ireland, then that would not reduce emissions. And they said, why not? And I said, because most of your agricultural products go into export. And if you now don't produce that here, then somebody else will produce it, maybe in Brazil or in Germany or who knows where. And all that would happen is that the emissions would migrate from Ireland to that other country where your slack is picked up. That's called leakage. That does not reduce emissions. It will not get you to where you need to go. And thank God they listened to me and to other colleagues, of course. Others were not so lucky. What you see here is a photo of very upset Dutch farmers. Why? Because the Dutch government decided they need to reduce nitrogen emissions. And that includes nitrates, nitrous oxide, which is a greenhouse gas, and ammonia. And so the Dutch government said, we need to reduce nitrogen emissions, and we put the lion's share of that need onto our farmers' shoulders. We want our farmers to reduce 30% of emissions. And the way we accomplish this is by shutting down a third of our livestock farms. Now, you need to know, globally, the United States is the number one agricultural country. The number two is the Netherlands. That tiny little country is the second most important exporter of agricultural goods. And their government said, let's shut down a third of our livestock farms to reduce nitrogen emissions. And then they said, we, the Dutch government, will put 25 billion, billion euros on the table to pay those farmers market value so that they get out. And then they told the farmers, if you take the money and you sell us your farm, then you sign this contract. And on the dotted line, you will sign that you will never become a farmer again. And neither will your kids. Now let that sink in. If you want to really upset farmers, that's what you've got to do. And that's what it leads to. 40, 50,000 farmers on their tractors, blocking The Hague and other places all throughout the Netherlands. And people, bystanders, the normal citizens, they stood on the wayside and they applauded. They applauded the farmers. They were on the farmers' side by the overwhelming majority. And then recently they had regional elections. And the Farmers' Party, BBB, became the strongest party. And they are now able to block this foolishness, okay? The Dutch government is in disarray because of that. It all started with the farmers and thinking they could just bully the farmers around. The rest of the world has looked at that. I assure you, they have looked at this. They know that working against the farmers instead of with the farmers might not be the best recipe to follow. The Dutch Secretary of Agriculture had to resign, or resigned. I don't know what happened there, but nobody seems to want the job now. The parliament is reshuffled because of this new party and so on. So anyhow, so that's called the Cain approach, okay? It doesn't work particularly well, I assure you that. In the United States, we see a different approach. We see the carrot approach. A carrot approach in a way where investments are made into climate-smart commodities, where money goes to organizations such as the California Dairy Research Foundation to study ways of reducing emissions. In California in particular, we have a very rigid, a very strict law that's called SB 1383. And this law mandates a 40% reduction, 40, of methane to be achieved by the year 2030. That is the most aggressive reduction goal in the world. 40% to be achieved by the year 2030. The law says that these reductions should occur from manure mitigation efforts. The state has offered some funding, not very much, I might say, but some funding. In fact, the dairy sector is the most important animal agricultural sector in California. 20% of U.S. milk is produced in California on about 1,500 dairies. 2% of all public funds in California, spent in California, to reduce methane. 2% of these public funds went into the dairy sector to help dairies, for example, cover their lagoons. You see it there at the bottom right. 2% went into the dairy sector, and that 2% investment has led to a 30% reduction of methane. a 15x return on investment. This here is a depiction of all the sectors in California that receive public funds to reduce methane. And look at the top. Of the 2% investment that went to the dairy sector, 30% reductions of methane was achieved. Now, that has gotten every agency and legislator in the state to pay attention. Because what has started as a voluntary incentive-based approach, working with the farmers, seems to work. Every parent in the room knows that the carrot approach works much better than the cane approach. But many legislators throughout the world did not learn that lesson yet. But I think they're about to learn it because we see amazing results through that carrot approach. And I'm kind of proud of being part of that. Now, California has many things wrong, but in that respect, they have really done something very well, I believe. If you look at all methane, this is not all greenhouse gas, this is just methane. In California, you see that dairy manure and dairy enteric means the methane that comes out of the front end, that these two alone make up about half of all California's methane. So that's a very significant portion, and therefore these sectors will not slide underneath the radar screen. The goal for our dairy sector is to reduce 7.2, that's the number, 7.2 million metric tons. That's how much they need to reduce. The beef sector needs to reduce 1.8. So that is the number that equates with a 40% reduction, okay? So keep in mind, 7.2 for dairy. Now, our farmers 5 years ago said, this is not possible. Never in the world can we achieve that. 5 years ago, we had about a dozen anaerobic digesters in California. Most of them didn't work. They were European models that didn't work under our conditions. Since then, developers have built 200 covered lagoon digesters. They are large, and they are implemented on dairies with 2,000 cows and more. And the developers have books that are filled to the hilt. They cannot build those things fast enough. Why? Because those dairies who do what I just said, who build digesters, now trap the gas that normally comes off that animal manure. They trap that gas. It's called biogas. 60% of biogas is methane. They trap that gas, and then they convert it into a vehicle fuel called renewable natural gas. And this vehicle fuel goes into the transportation fleet, into semi-trucks and buses and so on. It can also go into heavy industries like steel industry. This is pretty much like natural gas, okay? So those dairies that do that, convert this methane that used to be a pollutant, convert that into transportation fuel, and therefore replacing the original diesel with a much cleaner RNG, they receive a credit called Low Carbon Fuel Standard Credit. That's what it's called. It's a mouthful. Low Carbon Fuel Standard Credit. They are guaranteed for 10 years, and they are so high that they, particularly about 2 years ago, amounted to about half of the value of the milk that the dairy sells. So if it was $4,000 that a dairy made for the sale of the milk per cow per year, they received $2,000 for the sale of their biogas per cow per year. And that got everybody's attention. And that is why we now have this mad rush into building these digesters on dairies. Not just because people want to be greener, but also because it's lucrative. It's not a subsidy, okay? This is not a subsidy by the state to the farmer. This is a new income stream because in addition to selling milk, they are now selling this product on the market. And the reason why they can do that, and this is critically important for other states, if other states decide to follow suit, that is only possible if you have a market. If you don't have a market, and if you can't financially benefit from reducing emissions, it will not happen. It will not happen. But because there is a market, people want to be players at that market. Our dairy industry has fully bought into this. This here is a report that two of my colleagues, Dan Sumner and Ermius Cabriap, and I wrote and submitted to the legislature and to our main agencies. It's called Meeting the Call. If you take a photo of that QR code, you get to the report. This report really shows what the mandate, the legislative mandate was, what our farmers have done to meet that mandate, and how we are about to achieve that mandate. And we are doing it without breaking the bank. That's the most important part. Our state has learned that working with farmers, rather working against them, might be a much better model to be used in the future. And that makes me very hopeful and very happy. Just to give you a feel for where we are, so we are supposed to reduce for the dairy sector 7.2 million metric tons. Here are some of the means that get us there. We have a slight herd reduction of 0.5%, so half of 1% annually. And that's because our cows become more and more productive, and therefore we can produce a similar amount of milk with fewer cows. We have a slight, what's called attrition. Then we have these anaerobic digesters that reduce a lot of methane. We have alternative manure management practices. And in the future, we will have enteric feed additives, additives that you can feed to cattle to reduce methane. That combined will reduce 7.6 to 10.6 million metric tons. The goal is 7.2. We will overachieve that goal. And what that really means, I will show you in a minute. Because when we reduce methane, we have an immediate impact on climate. And that's really exciting. So I will now talk about methane, okay? First of all, what are greenhouse gases and why do they affect the climate? We hear it all the time, but most people don't really know what it means. What you see on this slide is the sun radiating down solar beams to the surface of the Earth. Normally, they would be reflected back into space, and with it, the heat that comes with those solar beams. If there weren't a blanket of greenhouse gases, and just like a blanket that you put over your body that retains your body heat close to you, these greenhouse gases retain the heat from the sun in our atmosphere. That's very important. Without greenhouse gases, life on planet Earth would not be possible. It would be too cold here. So we now have that blanket, and it's good that we have the blanket, but the problem is we are producing too many greenhouse gases, and that's making that blanket too thick. And that leads to the warming effect. That's where the problem lies. And while most people will say CO2 carbon dioxide is the main culprit of human-caused climate change, our special friends say, no, it's methane. And methane comes from cows, therefore we have to get rid of cows. And therefore, the best way of doing that is if we all become vegetarians or vegans, that's how we fastest get that accomplished. That's what you hear in New York City. That's what you hear in Los Angeles. That's what you hear up and down major population centers. So whether or not that's the case, you will hear in the next few minutes. When methane is compared to other greenhouse gases, a unit is called, it's called a matrix that is used, that's called global warming potential, GWP100. And you will hear me referring to that repeatedly. GWP100 compares carbon dioxide to methane and nitrous oxide. And what it says is that one molecule of methane is 28 times more potent than one molecule of CO2. And it says that one molecule of nitrous oxide is 265 times more powerful than CO2. The best analogy I give my students so that they really understand is to say, imagine we drink the same beverage containers but filled with different beverages. You drink beer, you drink wine, and you drink vodka. Who will get drunk first? Everybody gets that, okay? And you can measure that by using blood alcohol or breath alcohol. Now, the blood alcohol or breath alcohol for gases is this GWP100 that simply says methane is 28 times more potent than CO2. So if you have a farm and you produce 10 tons of methane, and you want to know what does that really mean, all you need to do is multiply it with that factor 28. 10 tons from your farm times 28 is 280 tons of CO2e, CO2 equivalent emissions. Is everybody with me? Same thing with nitrous oxide. If you produce 10 tons of nitrous oxide, that equates to 2,650 tons of CO2e. And that's how these things are calculated. That's how the journalists who compare cows versus cars, that's how they're calculated. They count the tons or the kilograms or whatever from a farm, and then they compare that directly to vehicles or other sources. Now, I have disliked this matrix GWP100 forever, and I have criticized it forever, and I have said forever that it is inaccurate because methane is special. And I will tell you on the next slide why it's so special. I have been raked over the coals for saying what I'm about to say, but now it's pretty much well accepted. What am I talking about? I'm talking about why methane is special. What you see on this slide is the global methane budget. On the left side, you see several sources, including fossil fuels, agriculture and waste, biomass burning, wetlands, and so on. All these sources globally combined amount to 500 and almost 560 teragrams. That's where the reporting in the media stops, not acknowledging that methane is not just produced, but methane is also destroyed. On the right side, you see that there are sinks, and these sinks amount to almost 550 teragrams globally. In other words, 560 are produced, 550 are destroyed, and that leaves the balance, which is 10. 10 is still a number we seek to further reduce, don't get me wrong, but it's definitely very different from looking at just sources. So what is it that destroys methane? You see this large arrow pointing down, and underneath it says, sink from chemical reactions in the atmosphere. What is that? If this microphone were a methane molecule, then within about a decade or so, about 12 years after being in the air, that methane molecule would be attacked by another molecule called a radical. That's what they're called hydroxyl radicals. These hydroxyl radicals kill the methane, and that happens in around one decade. The same does not happen to CO2, the same does not happen to nitrous oxide. It only happens to methane, and the world media is ignoring it, has been ignoring it, and that's a problem. Why is it a problem? Because it fundamentally changes the way this gas warms the planet. So, remember from this slide, methane is not just produced, methane is also destroyed. Why does that matter? Because it affects the lifespan of this gas in the atmosphere. When we burn gas or oil or coal, we put CO2 into the air. That CO2 stays in the air for 1,000 years because there's nothing else that destroys it. Similarly, nitrous oxide, once that's in the air, stays there for well over 100 years. But when your cows belch out methane, that methane will meet this hydroxyl radical after about a decade, and that's why the lifespan is so short, 12 years. That does not mean that methane doesn't matter. Methane does matter. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas, but it has a very short lifespan. This is almost like you drinking a tequila, but in 10 minutes you have metabolized it. You no longer feel it, okay? Which is not the case, but I'm just making up some weird analogies here. This slide here is a very important one, but also a confusing one. And so please pay real good attention to this. People compare cars versus cows, or power plants versus cows, and so on. And I've been telling them for a long time, don't do that, because fossil carbon is very different from biogenic carbon. What do I mean when I say fossil carbon? Fossil carbon is oil, coal, gas that used to be in the ground for a very long time. That stuff originally was animal and plant material. It lived, died, decayed, fossilized, accumulated in the ground for a long time until 70 years ago, humans started to take it out. And so far we have taken about half of all fossil fuels that used to be down there out of the ground. What did we do with that fossil carbon? We burned it. So where's that carbon now? I see fingers going up. Exactly, it's now in the atmosphere. It's not a value statement, Frank hating oil companies or so, not at all. But I'm just saying that is the way that carbon goes from the ground where it was for a long time into the atmosphere. And every time the sun hits those molecules, they heat up. Now we go to a much more complicated thing, which is biogenic carbon. Where does that come from? It starts with atmospheric CO2. During photosynthesis, we've all learned that in school, CO2 is taken on by plants. The plants then convert that CO2, that carbon in the CO2, into cellulose or starch. And some of that carbon stays above ground, but the majority of that carbon goes below ground, first into the roots. And then it's taken on by soil microbes, a process called soil carbon sequestration. Healthy soils have the potential to capture about one-third of all human-caused carbon. Our farmers and our foresters are getting zero credit for that right now. But healthy soils are very important in our fight against the changing climate. And farmers and foresters are the ones that have custody over those lands doing that. So our cow, of course, comes into play and eats some of the above-ground vegetation. And here, particularly cellulose. The world's most abundant biomass is cellulose. The world's most abundant biomass is cellulose. The only animals that can digest that and make it into human-sourced food are ruminants. Without ruminants, we could not make use of 70% of all agricultural lands. I repeat that. Without ruminants, we could not make use of 70% of all agricultural land. These lands are called marginal lands. Why not? Because we can't grow crops on these lands. They are not fertile enough. There's not enough water. They might be too hilly, too rocky, too whatever. We cannot grow crops there. But we can send livestock there. Ruminant livestock upcycled cellulose into the food we all cherish so much. But the unintended consequences of the microbes in their gut, in their rumen, converting cellulose into volatile fatty acids and so on, the unintended consequence is methane production. These microbes produce methane, that methane builds up, and it comes out the front end, enteric emissions it's called. And while that methane is in the air, it traps heat, and we seek to reduce that methane. But after about 10 to 12 years, that methane molecule is converted back to where it came from, CO2. So on the right side, you have a biogenic carbon cycle of CO2 going into plants, becoming cellulose, and being stored in the ground. Then the animals eat that biomass, produce methane. That methane stays in the air for 10 years, and then it becomes CO2 again. This is a cycle on the right side. It's a one-way street on the left side. Every time we burn fossil fuel, we add new additional warming to our planet. But the same is not true for our cows. If you have a constant source of methane, such as a constant cattle herd, then almost the same amount of methane that's produced by those animals is also destroyed. A constant herd, a constant source of methane, does not add additional warming to our planet. If we grow herds, let's say from 1 million to 1.5 million in a given location, then we are increasing methane. That increases warming. We don't want to do that. That's, by the way, happening in parts of the developing world. It's not happening here, but it is happening in parts of the developing world. And now comes what's really exciting. If you learn to reduce methane, then you instantaneously reduce warming. If you reduce methane, you reduce warming. And all of you are part of making that happen. Through breeding, through feeding, through improvements in efficiencies, land management, and so on. Is this clear to everybody here? You have a one-way street on the one side, you have a biogenic cycle on the other side. That's a very big difference. I will now explain how two key gases differ. And that's really important in the understanding of why methane needs to be rethought. Imagine you were to live 20 miles away from work, and on Monday you drive your car to work. When you do, you put CO2 into the air, it stays there for 1,000 years. On Tuesday, you drive again, you put an equal amount of CO2 into the air and adding to the existing stock from the previous day. On Wednesday, you drive, on Thursday, on Friday, every time you drive a car, you add new additional carbon to the carbon from the previous day, the previous week, the previous month, previous year, decade, and so on. That's just the way it is, okay? That's just the way it is. When we burn fossil fuels, we add new additional warming every time we do it. Currently, livestock is regulated throughout the world as if the same thing were to happen when our cows belch or whenever their manure produces methane. Is that fair? No, it's not fair, because methane is not a stock gas that accumulates like CO2, but methane is a flow gas. It's not just produced, it's also destroyed. If you have a constant source of methane, you don't get additional warming. And that makes methane a totally different beast. I will now give you an analogy, because I love analogies, they help people to learn, of two bathtubs. The first one is a bathtub analogy for how CO2 warms the planet. Remember, CO2 is not removed. CO2 is just adding up, right? And then the second bathtub analogy will be one for how methane warms the planet. So let's start with CO2. So this is CO2. If you put the faucet on, then water runs into the bathtub. It goes up. The water goes up because there's no drain. There's no removal because there's no drain. So every time we turn on the faucet for CO2, the levels go up. That's what happens when we burn fossil fuel. Every time we do so, we add warming. So now let's look into the bathtub analogy for methane. If you turn the bathtub on, the faucet on normal, then water runs in, but the drain lets water out, and so the water level stays stable. If you turn the faucet on low and the drain is still open, then the water levels go down. And that means if you mitigate methane, then you reduce warming. And that's simply because in the one case, in the case of methane, you have an atmospheric removal. In the case of CO2, you do not. That gives us a very unique opportunity in animal agriculture because our main greenhouse gas is methane. All the other sectors of society have as a main greenhouse gas CO2. So colleagues of mine from Oxford University for years complained that this GWP100 that has been used for so long is grossly mischaracterizing particularly constant sources of methane, but also decreasing sources of methane. And they said that if you use GWP100 for a constant source, then you are overblowing its impact by a factor of 3 to 4. I've been saying it for years. Nobody listened. University of Oxford then went on to produce a new matrix called GWP star. And GWP star does account for the fact that this gas is not just produced, but also destroyed. And what shall I tell you? The Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, the world's highest organization dealing with climate, finally came to the realization that we were right. I highlighted it here, but because of the angle, I can't see it. What it says is that if you use GWP100 for a constant source, then you're overblowing the impact of that constant source on warming by a factor of 3 to 4. It says it in the world's most authoritative publication, the IPCC AR6 report. For the nerds among you, on page 123. I was just out of my mind happy that what I've been saying for years was now appreciated by the world's climate experts, totally ignored by agriculture. I do not understand why not every agriculturalist in this country and throughout the world knows this. Because methane is your Achilles heel. Your special friends want to get you by using methane against you. It is very important that you understand why methane is so different and what managing methane can do to our climate. Namely, you can show that you care, you're taking this seriously, you're addressing concerns that society has about your sector. I will now show you how important it is not to use this old unit GWP100, but the much more accurate unit GWP star. And I use three scenarios. One, where over 30 years, methane is increasing by, what does it say, 30% or so? 35%. The second one is a scenario where over 30 years, methane is slightly reduced by 10%. And the third scenario, one where methane is strongly reduced by 35%. How would this increasing, the stable, and the decreasing methane scenario be characterized using this old GWP100 matrix? GWP100 would say that in all three scenarios, we're adding a lot of additional CO2 equivalent emissions, causing a lot of additional warming. And we now know that's wrong. But the world has been using this matrix up until today. And everybody is regulated based on that. The new matrix, GWP star, shows a different picture. If you increase methane, then you increase warming. That's the blue north of the x-axis. If you increase methane over time, you are adding a lot of additional warming to our planet. We don't want to do that. And unfortunately, it's happening in part of the developing world. If you slightly reduce methane, and that's what's happening in most of the United States, if you slightly reduce methane, then you don't see any additional warming. You actually see, because there's a 10% reduction, some blue south of the x-axis, meaning there's a little bit of negative warming, we call it. My colleagues in Oxford called it cooling. Negative warming happening. If you reduce methane by a lot, let's say 35%, look what happens to warming. You are drastically reducing warming. If you reduce methane by a lot, you have a very drastic impact on warming. And that's a very positive one. It's called negative warming, but it's a good thing, okay? So that is the same effect. Reducing methane from livestock is the same effect you would get as if you were to plant forests, which also suck carbon out of the atmosphere, or plants do. By reducing methane, we have a real impact on climate. So I will not bore you too much with the other details here, but I want to impose upon you that this law we have in California that mandates the 40% methane reduction is on a very good trajectory to being met. This technology alone, these anaerobic digesters, these covered lagoons, have led to a situation where our dairy sector has already achieved 30% of its methane reduction goal. We will reduce 40% methane within the next 7 or so years, and the impact that will have on climate I showed you on the previous slide. It's very important that we use the most scientific means to quantify that impact on warming and that we talk about it. That is very important. This is what it looks like when you take dairy biogas, you convert it into transportation fuel, and then you put it into vehicles. This is a RNG filling station, renewable natural gas. So that gas came from dairies. It's now powering heavy-duty trucks and buses. Soon we'll have so much of this dairy biogas that we run out of trucks to put it into. And then that dairy biogas will go into EV, electric vehicles, and into heavy-duty industries like the steel industry. We have a lot of places where we can put that stuff into. And this pathway is considered the most carbon negative pathway there is. That is why the dairies get paid such a high credit, because it is so different from the fossil fuel carbon intensity. So there are other means of reducing greenhouse gas methane. This here is a selection of feed additives that have been developed. Most of them are available in other parts of the world, in Europe, in Australia, in New Zealand, in South America, but not in North America. Not in the U.S. Why not in the U.S.? Because in the U.S., the FDA, Food and Drug Administration, has the oversight, and they view feed additives as drugs rather than feed additives, which they are. And so it's likely that there will be some changes within the FDA in how they evaluate feed additives, because if they don't make these changes, we will not have these tools at our disposal. Recently, I was in New Zealand, and I saw many dairies and other operations, and of course beef operations. They are almost totally pasture-based over there, and they do research into the following. A bolus that you lodge into the rumen of animals, and it slowly releases an active ingredient reducing methane. That's one way. Another way that's kind of promising is the use of breeding. There are now companies that develop genomic tests for methane, because they have found on the dairy side that methane is a heritable trait. You can test a cow for whether or not she's a high or low methane producer, and you can breed accordingly. And I know this is a crowd that might be interested in this. I think in the future there will be a methane EPD. And that is a permanent reduction of methane. That's not a temporary one like feed additives. That's a permanent one. So breeding will have a lot to do with methane reduction in the future, in my opinion. The New Zealanders are also working on a methane vaccine. That's not ready for prime time, but there is such work going on. So there is work on the manure side, there's work on the enteric side, there's work on the breeding side, there's work on the vaccination side. We are firing on all cylinders to put tools in the hands of our producers to help them achieve those reduction goals. Unfortunately, in most of the United States, this topic is not as hot as it is in the state where I live. But I know other states are looking. They are wondering, why does that work over there? What have they done to make these changes? Why are methane reductions happening? Does it matter to us here in wherever, in the Dakotas or in Wisconsin? Maybe not yet. But believe me, the time will come. I think it is very important for you to position yourself wherever you are, whether you are in Oklahoma or Texas, whether you are in the Dakotas or elsewhere. I think we need to work on this now, find ways that work for your respective industries, and be aggressive about it before somebody is shoving it down your throat. The most important learning that I have made over the last 3 decades of my professional life is that a farmer wins when a farmer cares and shows that he or she cares. The National Pork Board have a We Care campaign. I love it. Because that is precisely what people who want to consume your products want to know, that you care for that land you have custody over. That you care like nobody else over the welfare of your animals. That you care about the products you produce. Of course, that you care for the people who work with you. We have to be more in the offensive rather than the defensive in and around sustainability. That is not a curse word. Sustainability is nothing else but stewardship. It's the same thing. Don't you want to be the best steward of your land, your animals, your people, your finances? All of that is sustainability. It's a term used by people in cities. Get over it. It's the same as stewardship. Be proud of being a great steward or being sustainable if you so wish. That is really important, okay? If there's one thing I've learned to study, it is how we need to communicate. Not just with our urban, with our rural communities, but also with those people in cities. In 98% of all refrigerators in the United States today, in 98%, you will find animal-sourced foods. The vast majority of people in this country like their bacon, their meat, their dairy, their eggs. There are a few very loud, very vocal ones who are predicting the demise of animal agriculture. They couldn't be further from the truth. And believe me, I actually got to meet those guys, the presidents of Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat. And so I've had dinner with them. I mean, believe it or not, don't ask me what I ate. I just want you to know that I think our industries have a great story to tell. But that doesn't mean we can be stagnant. That doesn't mean we can lean back and there's nothing else to learn. I think you need to take this topic really into consideration and work on it aggressively, because our example in California has shown that it works. Our farmers need to show that they are what we need to feed this country, to sustain this country, as much as we need a health sector to keep us healthy. I think this is really important. So I will jump a couple of slides here. I just want you to see this here. This is a white paper we wrote, Pathway to Climate Neutrality for U.S. Beef and Dairy. I recommend it. It also has Excel spreadsheets associated with it that you can use to calculate climate neutrality. That's the point we are seeking to reach, a point where you no longer add additional warming for the beef sector, for the dairy sector in your locality. This here is a report called Rethinking Methane. Sorry, not a report, a YouTube video, because now I'm trying to be a YouTube influencer myself. A five-minute video that explains why methane is so different and why it's so important for us to manage it. If we ignore methane, it's a problem. If we manage it, we can make it into part of a solution. And that is a totally different and new narrative. And of course, we have a webpage, the Clear Center does. I will show you that in a second. My Twitter handle is this one here, GHG Guru. And this is the Clear Center webpage. So with that, I thank you so much. I am so humbled. I'm proud to be here tonight. I thank you for your attention. And I hope that we have some time for questions if you are still awake and happy to ask. Thank you. Do I train graduate students? You bet I do. Several of them actually went to Oklahoma State right after they graduated. Sarah Place, Michelle Calvo, they were both professors here. They moved on since, but I have trained 20 PhD students so far. I always have 6 PhD students that I train, and they all become mini Frankies. No, but they all are trained in all those same fields that I research, and not just in the science, but also in the communications. When they finish a study, normally graduate students go to journal to animal science meetings, dairy science meetings, and so on, and they get to present 12-minute talks, very technical talks. My students, of course, have to do the same thing. But then after they do that, I say to them, and now you explain the same thing to a bunch of ministers or a bunch of legislators or a bunch of high school students or elementary school students. And they look at me as if I had lost my marbles. But that is an absolutely critical skill that you learn to read your audience and address them appropriately. So many professors have no clue how to do that. The graduate students coming out of my lab will, I guarantee you that. And I'm telling all the other educators that I'm dealing with, make sure your graduate students learn how to communicate. I have 1,500 undergraduate students in animal science at UC Davis. 1,500 and 200 graduate students. Sooner or later, I have contact with all of them. What is the acceptance of GWP star with my special friends? So first of all, GWP star is certainly not a matrix that is a get out of jail free card or so. It simply describes, using GWP 100 numbers over time, how an increase over time, a decrease over time, or a stagnant development over time affects the warming. And it has been published dozens of times since it came out a couple of years ago. It's now in the IPCC reports. It is considered a very accurate way of depicting the impact of this gas on warming. Now, my special friends don't like it because it makes the agricultural sector look very good if the agricultural sector does something. The same people, those special friends, who have been pounding the California agriculture industries for years to mitigate emissions, do something, do their share, are now strictly opposing the use of the technologies I just shared. For example, they are totally against the use of covered lagoons. And I say, well, why are you against covered lagoons? And they say because it favors large dairies, because small dairies can't use that technology. Well, that's true, but why would you not want the large dairies to do their share and the small dairies find a scalable solution that works for them? It makes no sense. That biogas that we are seeing generated with these covered lagoons is pipeline ready. It's going through a pipeline, it's then cleaned up, and then it's going to its eventual use. They had those special friends, they had asked for that to happen for the last 20 years. Now they have it, but they still don't like it. So you will never appease them, and I don't think it really matters. What matters is that we get the word out and the people in the public who care about eating animal-sourced foods but want to be assured that it's sustainably raised, they need to know it. And we are not very good telling this story as a total industry. Why is the methane capture going to fuel instead of electricity? Because electricity is too cheap in the country, in the United States. It would go into electricity in Europe because there the power costs are much higher. But here they are so low that it doesn't pencil out. But you can do it. You can make biogas into ethanol. You can make it into hydrogen. You can make it into renewable natural gas. You can make it into power. It's very versatile. It is really, if you think about it, it makes no sense to ignore methane because 10% of the energy we feed to a cow gets lost as methane. It's gone, 10%. It's a net loss to production when we lose methane. Some methane will always be lost, but we don't have to lose it all. The same is true for the methane that comes from manure storages. Why would we let it go if we can trap it and make something, do something with it? This is like keeping your doors and windows open in the middle of winter, letting your heat escape. It makes no sense. So we have to rethink methane. That's my take-home message. We have to rethink methane, and we have to rethink how we deal with this whole environmental and other sustainability stuff. Because we want to share with the world that we care, that we are serious about it, that we are the subject matter experts in this field. And without us, nothing will happen. We will not just shut down and go away. We will evolve, like we have evolved with all the other stuff you're discussing here on your EPDs for all kinds of trades. Think about what an incredible progress your industry has shown over the last few decades with respect to performance, with respect to all kinds of milk and meat trades. We are continuously evolving. Now we just have to also take things into consideration that previously didn't matter. Now they do matter. All of a sudden you have a situation where a Prop 12, a Prop 2, and so on, where they are reality. We can't say we don't care. We care. It's a problem. We just lost our last pork producers in California. And guess who is behind Prop 12? The HSUS, the Humane Society of the United States, they have pulled that off. What is the price of the fuel? Oh, I can't tell you what the price is, but what I can tell you is that it's cheaper than diesel. And so when certain transportation companies have to make a buying decision as to what kind of trucks they now buy RNG-ready trucks, and they can operate them cheaper and cleaner, and that's why they're doing it. Does RNG produce carbon dioxide? It does, but so does diesel. But when you compare the two, the RNG burning versus the diesel burning, the RNG burns much cleaner. So in addition to having a carbon advantage, it also has an air quality advantage because diesel also produces particles and other things that RNG doesn't. So that is why the payments are so high, because the California Air Resources Board, by the way, five of my former graduate students are now working there, the California Air Resources Board says, this is a double whammy for us. We are reducing emissions on the dairies, and we are reducing emissions in the transportation sector. That's a double whammy, and that's why those low-carbon fuel standard credits are so high. The environmental justice community, and that's how they're called, they want those credits to go away. They want them to go away. I just cannot understand the line of thinking. They don't want to reduce emissions, I can tell you that. They want to reduce farmers. They want to get rid of you. That's what they want. They don't want to reduce emissions. Because if they would, they would address this very differently. That's not to say that all of them are in one basket, okay? Many of them you can really work with. Recently I had a conference at UC Davis where the Environmental Defense Fund and several others partook the meeting, and they were reasonable. We could really work with them. So there are many environmental justice groups and NGOs you can work with. They want to reduce emissions, they will work with farmers. But then there are others who just will not. They just want to get rid of it. That's their business model. So in what form do they receive the credit? So the credit, by the way, has gone down. It's no longer at 2,000, but I don't know exactly where it is right now. But the way this works is, if you are a dairy and you buy your own digester, then all the proceeds are yours. Okay, all the credits are yours. But more often the dairies say, you know, I just don't want to deal with this. So I work with a developer, have that person put the digester down and operate. And all I do is give him or her my manure. I get a fee for that, and they're dealing with it. So there are these two different models of either dairy-owned or developer-owned. But these things, they're popping up everywhere. I mean, I think in 10 years, every dairy with more than 2,000 cows will have a digester, I have no doubt. No, the state does not write the dairy a check. When you first build a digester, you might get a grant. That 2% investment I alluded to initially, that is state-funded, but it's a small part of the total bill. It's pretty much a market, okay? It's a market. You are producing a fuel, and you're selling that fuel to the market, just like you produce milk and sell that milk to the market. It's a new product. It's a new product. There are two companies that produce the vast majority of those covered lagoons, and I know both of them. They have so many contracts pending, it's amazing. I'm surprised that we don't have 20 or 50 companies doing that, because the market is so large. And I cannot see that the rest of the country will... I cannot see that they won't follow. I think they will. But I also don't want to leave behind here the thought that all we can do is digesters. We can do many other things. And I want to impress upon you particularly that the breeding opportunity is huge. We need to find out what are the traits on the beef side that are related to methane, that are predictive for methane. On the dairy side, they use milk MIR. Milk MIR is a good predictor for methane. And so they take a snip out of the ear of the cow, and then they run their genomic test, and then they tell you, these cows here are low methane producers, these cows are high methane producers, and then they make breeding decisions based on that. Yes. Yeah, the question is methane production related to performance of dairy cows? This research was done at the University of Guelph, and the University of Guelph worked with the company CMEX on this. And I was in Scotland recently, and that's where the whole conference dealt with this one topic. And they said that they did not see a relationship of methane to performance, to yield or components. But it makes a big difference. I mean, we're talking about 20-30% methane differences. So it's a sizable difference. The question is, what are the traits on the beef side? That's what we need to figure out, because it's relatively easy to mitigate things like greenhouse gases on the dairy side, because they are much more intensive, or on the feedlot side. But what do you do with the cow-calf operation, where animals are on pasture, where you don't have daily access, and where you can't just give them feed additives, where the animals eat a very high roughage diet, which lends itself to high methane production? What do you do with them? And their breeding and bolus ideas and those kind of things will pop up. Yes. So what's the impact of the microbiome in a cow's rumen on methane? Well, first of all, this is a very complex issue, and I'm not a microbiologist by any means. But in some cases, there are rumen feed additives that you can feed to a cow. They will have an impact for a couple of weeks or months, and then they stop working because the microbiome swings back to what it was. Or certain microbes that were defeated are then replaced by others that also produce methane. There are some additives that work really well. They are interrupting the enzymatic production of methane, and that's two of them. One is called 3-NOP. It's also known to as Bovair. And the other one is red seaweed, a feed additive from Australia. I'm not very bullish, no pun intended, but not very bullish on seaweed because it has some unintended consequences on palatability and potentially toxicology. Because when it breaks down, this bromoform that is active, when it breaks down into bromine and iodine, both of which are toxins and can accumulate in the milk or meat.
There are... The microbiome is what drives this whole thing. And to influence the microbiome is what it's all about.
Some of my colleagues have just received a very large grant to affect the microbiome through work on CRISPR-Cas9 or whatever it's called.
Dr. Frank Mitlerner, University of California, Davis. He's known as the Greenhouse Guru, and he was your keynote speaker at the 2023 Cattlemen's Conference in Stillwater at Oklahoma State University. And that's all of our time for you right now for this first episode for Season 2 of Cattlemen's Congress Conversation. Remember, Cattlemen's Congress will be here before you know it, December 30th, 2023, through January 11th, 2024, at the Oklahoma City Fairgrounds. We'll have more from Cattlemen's Conference in our next podcast, as we'll look at some of the key things talked about by the cattle industry at this type conference, a blueprint for the future. I'm Ron Hayes with another edition of Cattlemen's Congress Conversation. We'll see you soon.